2343. We have Representative Jensen here. Welcome, Representative Jensen.
Senator Cork and members of the committee.
Oh, that's right. Mark, how don't you tell us what this bill does?
Thank you, Chair Corcoran. House Bill 2343 allows a person who made contributions to Judge's Retirement Fund but who is not eligible to become retired, a retired member of the Public Employees Retirement System, to withdraw amounts in the employee account at any time after an effective date.
Thank you. I think the history of this is that this measure was pretty much roundly supported in the last session, but then there was a deadly amendment added to it that that killed it, and we're trying to resurrect it. Is that correct, Representative?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, that is correct, Mr. Chairman. Your memory is, as usual, very sharp on these things, and we did have this bill or a bill of this nature before us last time trying to address this issue. It ran into trouble, and we found ourselves unable to get the job done. As a consequence, the bill is back before us now, and I believe I expect someone from PERS is here to respond to any perhaps of the technical issues that you might have with it. For the committee's refresher on this, it comes from a constituent of mine that was serving as a justice of peace and then was appointed by the governor to fill a vacancy as a district court judge back in the old days when we had district courts as well as circuit courts. He didn't win the popular vote when the election came up, and as a consequence moved back to his previous role and previous employment. During the period of time that he was in the district judge position, he paid in something approaching $1,000 to the public employee retirement system. And when he left that system, then he was unable to recover that. And I think there's a very good explanation of this in the background material that you have, and I won't bore you with reading that to you. Just simply to say that this was money that he could not recover. Normally it would be available on any retirement system to people, but the technicalities made this unavailable to him. Not only that, to add insult to injury, I would submit, they didn't even credit the account with any interest earnings that might have been there. They took the interest earnings on the account and turned it over to put it in the PERS account, which, of course, we all know we need there now, but, be that as it may. Judge Smallman, then, is simply asking the legislature to correct a situation that will allow him to get his $1,000 before he dies so that he can at least have enough money to take his wife out to a nice dinner someplace. He really doesn't want it to come to her as a benefit only after his death, sort of thing.
Representative Jensen, the only thing I need to clear up is that in 1991, the Judge's Retirement Fund was rolled into PERS, Mr. Delaney refers to the old Judge's Retirement Fund as that it became a last man's club, and I wondered if that was any reference to the Masters at all.
I'm sorry, Mr. Chairman. I'm not...
All right. You're off the hook. Any questions?
Aye.
Senator Bennis?
I'm ready to vote.
Oh, ready to vote. Okay, thank you very much. Mr. Delaney, you need to talk about a technical problem here. Please come forward. Bob, why don't you sit here and we can listen to this. And we might have to amend the bill a little bit here.
Oh, I hope not.
I don't know why it didn't. We'll ask why it didn't happen on the House side, too.
Mr. Chair, members of committee, for the record, my name is Steve Delaney, PERS Legislative Liaison. It's not a technical correction as much as we need the committee to go on record for the legislative history as to what is intended by a certain phrase within the bill itself. The House committee already has gone on record as to what was meant. They did not change the bill, however, and I've got their findings. The last paragraph of my testimony is what the House committee did with regard to this issue. The sentence, and Representative Jensen has heard this discussion, has to do with interest earnings. The sentence on line 19 of page 2 of the bill says that the person may withdraw the amounts deducted from the person's salary with all earnings on those deductions. Now, that can be read in two different ways. It can be read the contributions and earnings that were sent to PERS in 1991 and were held in this then dormant account, or that could also mean subsequent earnings from the time PERS took over caretaker of these dollars forward. Statute did not provide for any distribution of earnings to these dollars that PERS was handling simply in a caretaker fashion, and we were not paying any interest dollars on it. One account of these 14 has been paid out. A judge died, one of these inactive members died 2 years ago, and PERS paid simply the earnings, the contributions and earnings that came over in 91 to that individual. As you see, the House did go on record at the time they passed this bill out. They were concerned about setting precedent. They were looking, for instance, at the issue of loss of membership accounts, where PERS does not pay interest after 5 years if we cannot locate the individual. So they stated that their meaning behind this statement was only those contributions and earnings that PERS received in 1991 in caretaker status, and that they were not intending this language to mean that it was also subsequent earnings within the PERS fund. We simply need for this committee to indicate its meaning behind that phrase.
All right. The committee supports that position. Any discussion?
Well, Mr. Chair, this committee can say whatever it wants, but as we've stated in many committees in this building, it's not what the committee says. It's what's said on the House or the floor, whether it be the House or yes. The Senate. So I expect if we approve of that, somebody's going to be saying this on the Senate floor.
I think Mr. Delaney has already volunteered to provide such a statement to be read on the Senate floor when we move this bill.
I'd be more than happy to be able to
speak him.
Thank you very much.
Today.
We are in a work session, or just in public hearing. All right, close public hearing, open a work session on House Bill 2343.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Starr.
Let's move House Bill 2343 to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation.
I get by your anxiety to do this that you're very interested in the record still. Senator Starr moves House Bill 2343 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion?
I'm carrying three bills tomorrow. He's carrying one, so that's fine.
Okay, fine. Made that easy. Ms. Gravel, you call the roll?
Yes, sir.
Aye.
Senator Watford?
Aye.
Vice Chair Nunes?
Aye.
Chair Corcoran?
Aye. House Bill 2343 to the floor with the two pass and will be carried by Senator Starr, who is now two behind.
Thank you very much, Chairman Corcoran. I appreciate your hospitality and your care.
Thank you. You bet. Now go do the right thing over there on the other chamber, please.
Okay.
Thank you. Okay, we'll open a public hearing on House Bill 2676A and House Bill 3026, and we have the illustrious representative and chair of revenue, Lane Schitterer, here. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker, members of the committee. Glad to be with you and appreciate your early attention to House Bill 3026 and 2676. Did you open on both of them? I'll just give you a brief rundown then on both of them and be out of your way. They both passed unanimously out of the House. House Bill 2676 corrects a boundary error between Polk and Yamhill counties. In my private practice, I've seen parties go to court and spend thousands of dollars and years arguing over 3 to 5 feet and as much as 15 feet in a boundary dispute. Happily, Polk County and Yamhill County have agreed on this boundary. It's very interesting history. It goes back clear into the territorial days. But suffice to say that they need to get this clarified. And this does come with the support of the county commissioners out of both counties, as well as the county surveyors that have vetted the legal description and are satisfied with it. It doesn't change any private property legal descriptions, and I don't have much more to say about that. Other than it just solves their problems.
Any questions on that one, colleague?
Aye.
Okay, next.
House Bill 3026 comes to you from the Polk County Fair Board and the County Commissioners. Interestingly, the Polk County Fair, I think as many county fairs around the state, is having some funding issues. They explored the prospect last year of abolishing the fair board and going to a fair district, which is another way of funding county fairs. Basically, the difference being that a county fair board is a creature of the county general fund budget, depends on general fund revenues to support the county fair. Creation of a fair district, if the county wants to move that direction, would allow them to create it as a separate taxing district, and it has its own source then of funding as a fair district. In looking at the statute, they found there is a prohibition, and you'll see it on page 2, lines 12 and 13 of the bill, that says that only Washington County can repeal or abolish their fair board and enact a fair district for their county fair. It doesn't say Washington County, but it limits it to counties having a population of between 400,000 and 600,000, which happens to be Washington County. So the Polk County and any other similarly situated county is statutorily prohibited from abolishing their fair board and going to some other structure to operate their county fair.
Aye.
Thank you very much.
Okay. Any questions? Seeing none,
appreciate
thank you very much.
Your time and attention today.
Absolutely.
For Washington County, I bet it's good enough for...
Yeah, that was the prevailing sentiment. We want to be like Washington County.
Thank you. So you want to have high-tech firms leaving too?
Oh. We'll take them.
All right, we'll close the public hearings on House Bill 2676A and House Bill 3026. We're open to a work session on House Bill 2676A.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Walker.
I'll move House Bill 2676. To the floor of the Senate with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Walker moves House Bill 2676A to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Seeing none, Ms. Pavelli, call the roll.
Senator Starr?
Aye.
Senator Walker?
Boundary speech. Aye.
Vice Chair Minnick?
Aye.
Aye. Okay, we've got House Bill 2676A to the floor with a due pass. And since you're still behind, Senator Starr, do you want to carry this one too?
Sure.
Okay,
hey, I thought I was getting a package.
Thank you. We'll close that one. Now we will open a work session on House Bill 3026.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Starr.
Move House Bill 3026 to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Starr had the quicker trigger on Jeopardy. He moves House Bill 3026 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Hearing none, Senator.
This is
Mrs.
one of the like Washington County bill. So
another one. Okay.
Senator from Washington County ought to carry this bill as well.
Okay. Thank you for that point, Ms. Gravel.
Senator Starr.
Aye.
Senator Walker.
Aye.
Vice Chair Minnick.
Yes.
Chair Hooker.
Aye. Okay, House Bill 3026 to the floor with a due pass, and since I assigned the last two, Senator Starr, I might as well give this one to Senator Walker. Thank you. We'll close that one. Yes, you're welcome. I'm going to very quickly open a public hearing and possible work session on House Bill 2624, Senator Minnick.
Mr. Chairman, I would move House Bill 2624 be referred to the Senate President's desk for the purpose of referring it to the Senate Business and Labor Committee.
Senator Minnis moves House Bill 2624 be re-referred to the President's desk for recommended referral to the Senate Committee on Business and Labor. The only discussion point I have on this is that this is being done at the request of the Republican leadership in the Senate after discussion with the Democratic leadership. I think that it's unfortunate that there these kind of demands have to be made in this kind of a shared leadership, but given this the particular nature of this bill, I guess I'm not too surprised. This is a terrible bill. I hope it dies a very quick death over in business and labor. Any other discussion?
Chair, I'm happy to be serving on that committee.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much.
Another opportunity for the Senator from Eugene to carry a bill on the Senate floor.
If that's and make that the next bill she carries.
Mr. Chairman, I do have to say that I'm somewhat disappointed in the partisan rancor. But.
I know. It's unfortunate. And we'll have more of these before we're done, I'm sure. With that, Ms. Gravel, will you call the roll?
Senator Starr?
Aye.
Senator Walker?
Aye.
Vice Chairman?
No.
No? Okay.
Not this time.
Chair Buckley?
I protest. I'd love to do this, but I'm not going to. Yes. Okay.
Well, I could.
The House Bill 2624 is moved to the President's desk for re-referral.
I could. But it was a deal.
I just want to know what the Republican leadership is that you identified.
No comment. No comment. Okay.
I just made comment for the world.
Is Senator Burdick here? Oh, darn. Let's open a work session on Senate Bill 783. I mean, welcome, Senator Burdick.
Do you show proper respect, Mr. Chairman?
I thought it was proper respect.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
The sturdy senator from southwest Portland.
And tigered, Mr.
And
Chairman.
And tigered. Thank you, redistricting.
For the record, I am Jenny Burdick, state senator from District 18, here to support the a work session for Senate Bill 783 with the Dash 1 amendments, which were presented by the Department of Labor. Bureau of Labor and Industries, excuse me.
And, Mr. Ellsworth, do we have those amendments? I presume we do.
Chair Corcoran, members of the committee have been handed Dash 1 and Dash 2 amendments for this measure. The amendments have been drafted at the suggestion of Commissioner Gardner in his memo, which also is included in your packets. And the two amendments move the provisions of this measure from ORS 653 as originally drafted into ORS 659A as requested by Commissioner Gardner. Dash 1 stipulates that cases receive trial before a judge and remedies of reinstatement and back pay, where the Dash 2 amendments stipulate that the cases receive a jury trial and compensatory and punitive damages, with some slight variation.
Now, this is the second hearing on this, isn't it?
It is.
And so your recommendation, what you're recommending, Senator, is the Dash 1 amendments be adopted.
That's correct, Mr. Chairman. This is a bit of a softer approach than the Dash 2 amendments, and I think that's appropriate. I think the main value of this bill is to send the message to businesses that they need to be supportive and business-friendly to nursing moms.
Okay. Thank you very much. Any questions? I didn't give AOI a chance to testify the first time by oversight, and so I think I want to let them have their shot, and then we'll see if there's any other. Let's see. Do we have other? No, on this one. Just work. This is just work section. So yeah,
do we have a fiscal on this bill based on the amendment?
We do not have a fiscal based on this amendment.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, for the record, I'm Julie Brandes. Thank you, Mr. Chair, for giving us this opportunity to testify. We did submit our written comments to the committee right after that hearing that day, so you should have them in your record. We are primarily concerned with the legislation as it relates to the undefined terms within the bill. For example, an employer shall provide reasonable unpaid rest periods for expressing milk or nursing. Again, what is reasonable? Could this include the current breaks mandated by law? Those are generally pretty tightly constructed under current law. An employer shall make reasonable efforts to provide or a room or other location. Again, we're left in a situation where the Bureau will determine what is reasonable, and does this force all new small businesses as they construct their offices to put in a room for nursing. The employer is not required to provide rest periods if the rest period imposes undue hardship. Again, undue hardship is sort of awkwardly defined as significant difficulty, but significant difficulty is hardly a comfortable definition for the employer community. One of the those I'm sure are the concerns that you would expect us to express on a bill such as this.
To express?
I didn't mean to do that one.
For this committee.
She did it, not me.
The legal conflicts, however, I'd ask you to really consider. Oregon's family leave law, already known to be very complicated, requires an employer to return his or her employee to the exact same position when returning from family leave. We have fought this battle for years and years. I have the scars to prove it. Section 5 of this bill requires the employee to make a reasonable effort to temporarily change job duties if the employee's regular job duties do not allow for breastfeeding or expressing milk. And again, this just causes another change in Oregon's family leave law, and it could have add some complications, and it would be very hard to comply with that portion of it. So those are some of our concerns. I'm sure they're no surprise to you. So I'll answer any questions if you should have any.
Any questions? Seeing none. Senator Burdick, one thing we'd like you to clarify for the record is that you received a Legislative Council memo from Greg Chamoff dated April 11th regarding Senate Bill 873. It's unfortunate that our chief counsel is dyslexic, but would you like to comment on that particular?
Oh my goodness, I didn't notice that. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Yes, I asked that this be drafted in response to a concern that Senator Minnis brought to me about what it could mean for an employer to have to provide a room. There was concern among some people that that might cause businesses to have to add a room or so on. So I asked Mr. Chamoff to provide a legal opinion as to whether the language of the bill, which guards, which protects companies against unreasonable hardship, whether that would protect them adequately so that they wouldn't have to construct new rooms. And he said in this opinion that indeed it was protective and that you're not going to see companies having to do new construction to comply with this.
Okay, thank you very much. Any other discussion? Thank you, folks, very much.
Thank you.
What are we going to do with this bill, colleagues?
Mr. Chair.
Senator Walker.
I'd move the Dash 1 amendments.
Senator Walker moves the Dash 1 amendments to Senate Bill 783. Any discussion? Any objection? Seeing none, so adopted.
And Mr. Chair.
Oh, so adopted. Senator Walker.
I'd move Senate Bill 783 as amended to the floor of the Senate with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Walker moves Senate Bill 783 as adopted to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Seeing none, Ms. Gravel, will you call the roll?
Senator Scott?
Aye.
Senator Walker?
Aye.
Vice Chair Minnis?
Aye.
Chair Crosby?
Aye. Senate Bill 783 is amended to the floor with the due pass, and we'll let Senator Burdick carry it. Thank you. I think she's the sponsor. We'll make sure that she's the chief sponsor. Okay. Thank you. Okay. Let me just do some checking with the audience here. We have two bills before 2227. Are there folks here to talk about that? And 2818. Okay, so we're all set. All right. Is there anybody from outside of long distance here?
We don't have those here.
Oh, okay. 3026. We did. 2343. Yes. So we will open a public hearing on House Bill 2227A. Would you tell us what that does, Mr. Ellsworth, since I forgot to ask you to do this all afternoon?
Chair Corcoran, members of the committee, House Bill 2227A allows water utilities serving less than 500 customers to elect to be subject to financial regulation by the Public Utilities Commission. It permits the PUC to allow water utility rates to include costs for specific capital improvements, allows imposition of civil penalties of up to $500 for violation of PUC statutes, rule, or orders. Specifically, this specifies that penalty monies be directed back to the affected customers. It allows the PUC to accept applications from water utilities for an order designating the utility to have an exclusive service territory. It describes the procedures for application and PUC decisions on applications. It also, as amended, allows the PUC to set up aside up to $5,000 for emergency use by the utilities when funding is not available.
Thank you very much. Welcome, Commissioner.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I'm Roy Hemingway, the chair of the Public Utility Commission. I would just like to introduce Rick Willis, our executive director and legislative liaison, and Rebecca Hathorn, the chief of our water staff, who will talk about this bill.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Rick Willis, PUC. This bill is a result of a year-long review by a citizen group that we put together to take a look at our water processes and look for ways to streamline the way we do regulation. The bill does several things. It gives the commission authority to include in rates the cost of capital improvements while they're under construction. It allows water utilities to voluntarily seek exclusive service territories. It gives the commission authority to assess fines of up to $500 against water companies, and those monies would be used to go back to benefit the customers of that company. And lastly, it gives the commission authority to spend up to $5,000 to make emergency water repairs if we find that public health and safety are at risk and the company cannot or will not make the repairs. The commission then would recover those costs from the utility. We're not aware of any opposition to this bill, and it passed the House unanimously.
Mr. Willis, do you live 100 miles away from here?
No, sir.
Well, you are a sneaky devil then, because you checked the right box and you got to come up here and speak first. Now, Senator Moons, clarify for me the discussion about not bringing up the fact that there was a 56-0 vote in the other chamber. We're not supposed to do that.
I don't really care.
Okay, thank you very much. We will close the public hearing. Oh, do you folks have any more? I didn't think so. We'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2227A, and we'll open a work session.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Menes.
Move House Bill 2227, unamended to the floor of the Senate. With your pass recommendation.
Senator Menes moves House Bill 2227A to unamended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion?
I don't want
to
carry it.
Okay, fine. There's no discussion other than any meaningful discussion. Ms. Gravel, will you call the roll, please?
Senator Starr?
Aye.
Senator Walker?
Aye.
Vice Chair Nitt?
Aye.
Chair
Perkins? Aye. Senator Menes, are you sure you don't want to be engaged in this competition that's going on?
I don't really.
He's already ahead.
And with the current assignments of 2-1 today, what would that bring the...
No.
He's so far ahead that...
I only have one today.
She is so far ahead that it's going to take me virtually the rest of the session to try to get...
He keeps saying that.
I'll carry the bill. Thank you. Close the work session on 2227A, and we will open a work session on 2818. Excuse me, we will open a public hearing on... Can we open them both simultaneously? No. Okay. Public hearing on 2818. And we have Burton Weiss, Alec Jensen, and Jenna Ingram. I don't know if you guys are all on the same page on this. If you want, just come on up together. Unless you don't like each other or something. In which case, we really want you to come up together.
Mr. Chair, I'm Burton Weist. I'm here on behalf of the Special Districts Association of Oregon, which, along with the Fire Districts, Oregon Fire District Directors Association, and Tualatin Valley Fire and Rescue, were the sponsors of House Bill 2818. Jenna was representing OFDDA, and Alec is representing TVFNR. This bill deals with annexation policy, and the short history of this bill is that in previous years, it was generally the trend was for cities would annex into special districts as the cities grew, and special districts tended to be the rural service provider. Over the last 20 years, we've seen a significant change in that, and now we have the advent of very large special districts who are actually in the course of annexing cities instead of the other way around. And there's a lot of examples around the state I refer to in my testimony where you have cities and urban and rural areas that are all within a special district, such as Willamma Lane Park and Rec. Tuolumne Valley Fire and Rescue serves 13 cities. Clackamas Fire District 1 serves unincorporated areas and cities. And so this is a trend as local governments try to become more cost-effective, because there are simply some services that can be done more on a more cost-effective basis regionally than being done on an individual basis. One of the issues that arose with this trend is that the current statute treats special district annexations of cities slightly different than it treats cities annexing special districts. When a city annexes a special district, it is only the people who are being annexed who vote on that annexation. They're the people whose taxes are being affected, so that's appropriate. And in all other annexations, it's only the people who are being annexed whose taxes will change that have the vote. There is only one exception in the statute, and that's what this House bill does addresses. If a special district annexes a city, there is a requirement that there be a vote in both the special district doing the annexing and on the residents of the city that are doing the annexing. Now, historically, this hasn't been a big issue, but it has become an issue as these very large districts try to annex substantially smaller cities. It becomes an issue of cost. Mr. Jensen will talk about what they faced in Tuolumne Valley Fire and Rescue, looked at annexing West Lynn, which is where they have a very small population being annexed by a large district that actually has service in three counties, and then trying to explain that to your electors why they're voting on an issue to annex a small district.
So, Burton, just so I'm clear, that would have meant that everybody in the Tualatin Valley Special District would have had to, and the West Lynn folks who were proposed to be annexed, the mailing would have had to, the vote would have had to go out to everybody.
You would have had to pay for the cost of an election for all, what is there, 400,000 people would have had to been eligible for an election to annex a city of about 20,000 people.
And if it had been the opposite
other way,
direction,
if
only
West Lynn, for example, was annexing TVFNR, that had only been a vote in the territory to be annexed. Special districts are very adamant about people who are going to be annexed and be taxed have a right to vote. But this is not what's occurring in this case, because with the fixed tax rate in Measure 50, the people in the TVFNR are not going to be subject to a different tax by virtue of taxing. In the bill, further to protect, in case there's a political issue with the annexation, we also provided in the bill a safety valve which says if 100 or more people, regardless of the size of the annexing district, if 100 or more people sign a petition, then you still have to have an election in the district.
District-wide.
To protect it, so if there is a political issue in the district.
Senator Minnison, Senator Walker?
I'm wondering, what's the purpose of the annexation in this circumstance?
To provide fire service in the example that I gave you. It was TVFNR annexing. But this would apply. The other typical ones are park and water.
Well, why wouldn't you just use an intergovernmental agreement?
Well, because you want to annex the territory and have it be within, and its assessed value be within the district.
But again, why not an intergovernmental agreement? Because the city can assess their folks, can't they?
Well, I can...
The city of Wood Village contracts with the Sheriff's Department for police services. They obviously get the money from someplace.
Mr. Chair, Senator Minnison, I'm Alec Jensen. I'm the Executive Officer for Tuolumne Valley Fire and Rescue. And in fact, in some cases, we do operate under an intergovernmental agreement. We served Beaverton for a number of years under an intergovernmental agreement. We currently serve the cities of Oregon City and West Lynn under an intergovernmental agreement. But as you're aware, those are short-term, and they don't allow for the kind of long-term planning that's critical. And West Lynn is an example. They have tremendous infrastructure needs right now. They have two fire stations that are old and dilapidated and fire apparatus that need to be replaced. The Tualatin Valley Fire and Rescue can't levy in good conscience, or perhaps even legally, levy taxes to our constituents to underwrite the cost of that infrastructure.
But, Mr. Chairman, again, if you're annexing a city, the population within the city ultimately is going to pay for the fire service or whatever, police service, fire service, whatever it is, from their that portion of their the new taxing district, I assume, correct?
No, not necessarily. As if you're familiar with Tualatin Valley Fire and Rescue, you know we're a large regional provider, 23 fire stations, and we achieve economies by shifting resources around.
Mr. Chairman, you're making an argument against the bill. Because if, in fact, what you're telling me is that you're subsidizing the city that you're annexing and they're not paying their full share, then that would give justification to a vote by the entire district.
Mr. Chair, Senator Minnis, I appreciate your point. It may be a simple issue of semantics. Subsidization occurs even within a single jurisdiction. Low crime areas subsidize high crime areas, and low fire loss areas subsidize high fire loss areas. It is true that under certain circumstances, there may be situations where the taxpayers of Tigard underwrite the cost of infrastructure in the city of West Lynn. The reverse could be true under different circumstances. It's simply an issue of economies and long-term planning.
Mr. Jensen, maybe one point you're getting at to clarify is that you would be talking about actual construction here. Is that your concern, the fire station construction?
Well, that was, if I may, that is, of course, is one example that I gave. But the emphasis here from our perspective is on long-term planning.
Mr. Chairman,
go ahead, Senator.
Yes, what prevents an intergovernmental affairs agreement, excuse me, intergovernmental affairs
Intergovernmental.
I'm all screwed up here. An agreement.
Are you under investigation?
Probably. What prevents it from being for a longer, I mean, like a 10-year period or a 5-year period? Is there prohibition on the length of it?
Mr. Chair, Senator Minnis, to my knowledge, there is no prohibition on the length.
So why can't you do long-term agreements?
You could.
Well, if I may, Mr. Chair, also Senator Minnis, generally ORS 190 agreements or the intergovernmental agreements aren't in perpetuity. Generally, they have clauses where city councils or the other parties can withdraw from them a period of time. It's not typical for those agreements to be for extended periods of time. And generally, districts or cities don't like to build infrastructure and provide physical sites and buildings based on an ORS 190 agreement. So that's one reason people are reluctant to do it.
What's the longest you've seen?
Well, there's agreements. One that comes to mind is the agreement between West Lynn and Oregon City and some other folks on their water system. They have a joint water system that's a 190 agreement. And under that, the agreement is actually for 50 years, but there's a clause where the cities at certain windows, I think it's every 10 years or every 5 years, can review the agreement to withdraw it. So generally, 190 agreements aren't used for very long-term permanent agreements.
I think I'm okay. This occurs when the city asks for the annexation. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, Senator Minnis, the only way this bill goes into effect is if the city requests to be annexed.
Then you're okay. I think that works. And the city's actually asking for it. And there is an opening here then. For, what is it, 100 signatures?
100 signatures on a petition requires the vote. Out of, in TVFNR's case, 400,000 folks. So all you need is 100. And we did that for the very reason I think Senator Minnis raised, is we're not in the business here of pulling quick ones on the population, but we are in the business of saving $40,000, $50,000, $60,000 in election costs.
Right, I'm fine.
Thank you. I was going to ask Genoa to testify, but I was worried that Senator Minnis might ask her to bring in her attorney, and that might not be good for the bill. So I think if everybody's okay, we'll close the public hearing on this. Okay, Genoa, you want to say something?
Mr. Chair, I hate to...
For the record?
Genoa Ingram, Oregon Fire District Directors Association.
And I really hate to bring this up, but I just need to point out that this bill was brought forward to address the TVFNR situation, the annexation with West Lynn. Since it passed, might I add, unanimously in the House, another situation has come up where Clackamas 1 has wanted to annex Milwaukee. The problem is we're looking at that threshold of 10%, and Milwaukee represents a threshold of about 16%. And if the committee would indulge us, we would like to kick that 10 up to 20 so that it would address the Clackamas 1/Milwaukee, City of Milwaukee situation as well, unless it's going to cause a problem with the bill, in which case I'll just be quiet.
But in your case, this is a classic case. Now, is Milwaukee asking for the annexation?
Yes, Chair Corcoran, Burton Wiest, if I may, because I talked to them this morning. They called when we talked to them this morning. The City of Milwaukee is currently under a 190 agreement with Clackamas 1 and getting service from Clackamas 1. They basically used that as a trial run to see if it worked, if they were happy with the services. They are happy, and I found out this morning that the Milwaukee City Council is apparently considering putting on the ballot the annexation request in 2004. My initial response to them was, can't you wait? And but they are talking about doing the annexation in 2004.
Well, I personally wouldn't have much problem with entertaining such an amendment. I don't know how the committee feels.
So, Mr. Chairman, I'm somewhat uncomfortable with that, given the size of the City of Milwaukee. And I don't know about the politics of it. If I have people from City of Milwaukee sitting here tell me it's a great thing, but it's, you know, you're talking about a large metropolitan area. You're not talking about a small city like Wood Village, or I guess they can. Well, all right, they can get
it.
It would be how much is this enough, too? I guess.
I mean, you got local city councilors that have to be stand up in front of their electorate and say, hey, you know, I did this, and they have to stand accountable to that. Plus, you got the 100 signatures kind of pop off opportunity as well.
And Chair Corcoran, you also have the vote in the city. I mean, we're not removing the people of the city.
Right.
Even though city council says we want to be annexed, the city residents have to vote yes.
Right. Okay, well, we'll go into a work session and direct Ms. Ingram to work with Mark Ellsworth to get the draft and the amendment drafted.
Change one digit from 1 to 2.
Okay. Okay.
Last question.
Yes, sir.
Okay. Why is the percentage relevant at all?
Well,
asking for the annexation.
Chair Corcoran, Senator Menace, to be perfectly frank, we would prefer it didn't have a percentage in it at all, because the cities have no percentage when they annex a district. However, that percentage is in there because of a concern that some folks had some legislators had. There were some folks that were concerned that it should be only used in the case of where large districts are annexing cities. We also have the support of the League of Oregon Cities on this bill with a limitation on the percentage. So for that reason is why we put it in there.
All right. And they're fine with this proposed amendment?
Yes.
Okay. Any other discussion? Were you going to say something?
I was just going to say, I suspect you'll see my smiling face in a session or two removing the 20%.
Okay. With that, before we get into too much trouble, we'll close the public hearing, open a work session on Senate Bill or House Bill 2818, and Ms. Ingram will work with staff to develop the needed amendment, and we will close the work session and we'll adjourn. Thank you very much. Quick and efficient.